examples of this problem in Chapter 2. A second issue concerns incentives. Although the experimenter can give the students the correct incentives by designing the structure of their monetary payments to fit their performance in the game, the sizes of the payments are usually small, and even college students may not take them sufficiently seriously. By contrast, business games and even professional sports in the real world are played by experienced players for large stakes. For these reasons, one should not rely solely on any one form of evidence, whether it supports or rejects a theory, but should use both kinds and learn from each. With these cautions in mind, let us see how the two types of empirical approaches do. The field of industrial organization in economics provides the largest body of empirical testing of game-theoretic competition among firms. Industries, like auto manufacturing, have been studied in depth. These empirical investigators start with several handicaps. They do not know the firm's costs and demands from any independent source, and must estimate these things from the same data that they want to use for testing the pricing equilibrium. They do not know precisely how the quantities sold by each firm depend on the prices charged by all. In the examples in this chapter, we simply assumed a linear relationship, but the real-world counterparts, demand functions in the jargon of economics, can be nonlinear in quite complicated ways. The investigator must assume some specific form of nonlinearity. Real-life competition among firms is not just about prices. It has many other dimensions: advertising, investment, research and development. Real-life managers may not have the pure and simple aims of profit or shareholder value maximization that economic theory usually assumes. And competition among firms in real life extends over several years, so an appropriate combination of backward reasoning and Nash equilibrium concepts must be specified. And many other conditions, such as income and costs, change from one year to the next, and firms enter or exit the industry. The investigator must think about what all these other things might be and make proper allowance for, control for, in statistical jargon, their effects on quantities and prices. Real-world outcomes are also affected by many random factors, and so uncertainty must be allowed for. A researcher must make a choice in each of these matters and then derive equations that capture and quantify all the relevant effects. These equations are then fitted to the data, and statistical tests performed to see how well they do. Then comes an equally difficult problem. What does one conclude from the findings? For example, suppose the data do not fit your equations very well. Something in your specification that led to the equations was not correct. But what was it? It could be the nonlinear form of the equations you chose. It could be the exclusion of some relevant variable, like income, or some relevant dimension of competition, like advertising. Or it could be that the Nash equilibrium concept used in your derivations is invalid. Or it could be a combination of all these things. You cannot conclude that Nash equilibrium is incorrect when something else might be wrong. But you would be right to raise your level of doubt about the equilibrium concept. Different researchers have made different choices in all these matters and, predictably, have found different results. After a thorough survey of this research, Peter Rees and Frank Wallach of Stanford University give a mixed verdict. The bad news is that the underlying economics can make the empirical models extremely complex. The good news is that the attempts so far have begun to define the issues that need to be addressed. In other words, more research is needed. Another active area for empirical estimation concerns auctions, where a small number of strategically aware firms interact in bidding for things like bandwidths in the airwave spectrum. In these auctions, asymmetry of information is a key issue for the bidders and also for the auctioneer. Therefore, we postpone the discussion of auctions to Chapter 10. After we have examined the general issues of information in games in Chapter 8. Here we merely mention that empirical estimation of auction games is already having considerable success. What do laboratory experiments have to say about the predictive power of game theory? Here the record is also mixed. Among the earliest experiments were the markets set up by Vernon Smith. He found surprisingly good results for game theory as well as for economic theory. Small numbers of traders, each with no direct knowledge of the other's costs or values, could achieve equilibrium exchanges very quickly. Other experiments with different kinds of games yielded outcomes that seemed contradictory to theoretical predictions. For example, in the ultimatum game, where one player makes a take-it-or-leave-it offer to the other for dividing a given sum between the two, the offers were surprisingly generous. And in prisoners' dilemmas, good behavior occurred far more frequently than theory might lead people to believe. We discussed some of these findings in chapters 2 and 3. Our general conclusion was that the participants in these games had different preferences or valuations than the purely selfish ones that used to be the natural assumption in economics. This is an interesting and important finding on its own. However, once the realistic social or other regarding preferences are allowed for, the theoretical concepts of equilibrium, backward reasoning in sequential move games, and Nash in simultaneous move games yield generally good explanations of the observed outcomes. When a game does not have a unique Nash equilibrium, the players have the additional problem of locating a focal point or some other method of selection among the possible equilibria. How well they succeed depends on the context, in just the way that theory suggests. If the players have sufficiently common understanding for their expectations to converge, they will succeed in settling on a good outcome. Otherwise, disequilibrium may persist. Most experiments work with subjects who have no prior experience playing the particular game. The behavior of these novices does not initially conform to equilibrium theory, but it often converges to equilibrium as they gain experience. But some uncertainty about what the other player will do persists, and a good concept of equilibrium should allow players to recognize such uncertainty and respond to it. One such extension of the Nash equilibrium concept has become increasingly popular. This is the quantile response equilibrium, developed by Professors Richard McKelvey and Thomas Palfrey of Caltech. This is too technical for a book like ours, but some readers may be inspired to read and study it. After a detailed review of the relevant work, two of the top researchers in the field of experimental economics, Charles Holt of the University of Virginia and Alvin Roth of Harvard University, offer a guardedly optimistic prognosis. In the last 20 years, the notion of Nash equilibrium has become a required part of the toolkit for economists and other social and behavioral scientists. There have been modifications, generalizations, and refinements. But the basic equilibrium analysis is the place to begin and sometimes end the analysis of strategic interactions. We think that to be exactly the right attitude and recommend this approach to our readers. When studying or playing a game, begin with the Nash equilibrium, and then think of reasons why, and the manner in which the outcome may differ from the Nash predictions. This dual approach is more likely to give you a good understanding, or success in actual play, than either a totally nihilistic anything-goes attitude or a slavishly naive adherence to the Nash equilibrium with additional assumptions, such as selfishness. Case study, halfway. A Nash equilibrium is a combination of two conditions. 1. Each player is choosing a best response to what he believes the other players will do in the game. 2. Each player's beliefs are correct. The other players are doing just what everyone else thinks they are doing. It is easier to describe this outcome in a two-player game. Our two players, Abe and B, each have beliefs about what the other will do. Based on those beliefs, Abe and B each choose to take an action that maximizes their payoffs. The beliefs prove right. Abe's best response to what he thinks B is doing is just what B thought Abe would do. And B's best response to what she thought Abe would do is indeed just what Abe expected her to do. Let's look at these two conditions separately. The first condition is quite natural. If otherwise, then you'd have to argue that someone is not taking the best action given what he or she believes. If he or she had something better, why not do it? Mostly the rub comes in the second condition, that everyone is correct in what they believe. For Sherlock Holmes and Professor Moriarty, this was not a problem. "All that I have to say has already crossed your mind," said he. "Then possibly my answer has crossed yours," I replied. "You stand fast?" "Absolutely." For the rest of us, correctly anticipating what the other side will do is often a challenge. The following simple game will help illustrate the interplay between these two conditions and why you might or might not want to accept them. Abe and B are playing a game with the following rules. Each player is to pick a number between 0 and 100, inclusive. There is a $100 prize to the player whose number is closest to half the other person's number. We'll be Abe, and you can play B. Any questions? What if there's a tie? Okay, in that case, we split the prize. Any other questions? No. Great, then let's play. We've picked our number. Time for you to pick yours. What is your number? To help keep yourself honest, write it down. Case discussion. We picked 50. No, we didn't. To see what we actually picked, you'll have to read on. Let's start by taking a step back and use the two-step approach to finding a Nash equilibrium. In step one, we believe that your strategy had to be an optimal response to something we might have done. Since our number has to be something between 0 and 100, we figure that you couldn't have picked any number bigger than 50. For example, the number 60 is only an optimal response if you thought we would pick 120, something we couldn't do under the rules. What that tells us is that if your choice was truly a best response to something we might have done, you had to pick a number between 0 and 50. By the same token, if we picked a number based on something that you might have done, we would have picked something between 0 and 50. Believe it or not, many folks stop right there. When this game is played among people who haven't read this book, the most common response is 50. Frankly, we think that is a pretty lame answer, with apologies if that's what you picked. Remember that 50 is only the best choice if you think that the other side was going to pick 100. But in order for the other side to pick 100, they would have to have misunderstood the game. They would have had to pick a number that had almost no chance of winning. Any number less than 100 will beat 100. We will assume that your strategy was a best response to something we might have done, and so it is between 0 and 50. That means our best choice should be something between 0 and 25. Note that at this juncture, we have taken a critical step. It may seem so natural that you didn't even notice. We are no longer relying on our first condition that our strategy is a best response. We have taken the next step and proposed that our strategy should be a best response to something that is a best response from you. If you are going to do something that is a best response, we should be doing something that is a best response to a best response. At this point, we are beginning to form some beliefs about your actions. Instead of imagining that you can do anything allowed by the rules, we are going to assume that you will actually have picked a move that is a best response. Given the quite sensible belief that you are not going to do something that doesn't make sense, it then follows that we should only pick a number between 0 and 25. Of course, by the same token, you should be realizing that we won't be picking a number bigger than 50. If you think that way, then you won't pick a number bigger than 25. As you might have guessed, the experimental evidence shows that after 50, 25 is the most common guess in this game. Frankly, 25 is a much better guess than 50, at least it has a chance of winning if the other player was foolish enough to pick 50. If we take the view that you are only going to pick a number between 0 and 25, then our best response is now limited to numbers between 0 and 12.5. In fact, 12.5 is our guess. We'll win if our guess is closer to half your number than your number is to half ours. That means we win if you picked anything higher than 12.5. Did we win? Why did we pick 12.5? We thought you would pick a number between 0 and 25, and that's because we thought you'd think we'd pick a number between 0 and 50. We could, of course, go on with our reasoning and conclude that you'd figure we'd pick a number between 0 and 25, leading you to choose something between 0 and 12.5. If you had thought that, then you'd be one step ahead of us and would have won. Our experience suggests that most people don't think more than two or three levels, at least on their first go-round. Now that you've had some practice and better understand the game, you might want a rematch. That's fair. So write down your number again. We promise not to peek. We are pretty confident that you expect us to pick something less than 12.5. That means you'll pick something less than 6.25. And if we think you'll pick something less than 6.25, we should pick a number less than 3.125. Now, if this were the first go-round, we might stop there. But we just explained that most folks stop after two levels of reasoning. And this time, we expect that you are determined to beat us, so you'll engage in at least one more level of thinking ahead. If you expect us to pick 3.125, then you'll pick 1.5625, which leads us to think of 0.78125. At this point, we are guessing that you can see where this is all heading. If you think we are going to pick a number between 0 and x, then you should pick something between 0 and x divided by 2. And if we think you are going to pick something between 0 and x divided by 2, then we should pick something between 0 and x divided by 4. The only way that we can both be right is if we both pick 0. That's what we've done. This is the Nash equilibrium. If you pick 0, we want to pick 0. If we pick 0, you want to pick 0. Thus, if we both correctly anticipate what the other will do, we both do best picking 0, just what we expected the other to do. We should have picked 0 the first time around as well. If you pick x and we pick 0, then we win. That is because 0 is closer to x divided by 2 than x is to 0 divided by 2, equals 0. We knew this all along, but didn't want to give it away the first time we played. As it turned out, we didn't actually need to know anything about what you might be doing to pick 0. But that is a highly unusual case and an artifact of having only two players in the game. Let's modify the game to add more players. Now the person whose number is closest to half the average number wins. Under these rules, it is no longer the case that 0 always wins. If there are three players, and the other two have picked 1 and 5, then the average of the three numbers, 0, 1, and 5, is 2. Half the average is 1, and the person picking 1 will win. But it is still the case that the best responses converge to 0. In the first round of reasoning, all players will pick something between 0 and 50. The average number picked can't be above 100, so half the average is bounded by 50. In the second iteration of logic, if everyone thinks others will play a best response, then in response, everyone should pick something between 0 and 25. In the third iteration of logic, they'll all pick something between 0 and 12.5. How far people are able to go in this reasoning is a judgment call. Again, our experience suggests that most people stop at two or three levels of reasoning. The case of a Nash equilibrium requires that the players follow the logic all the way. Each player picks a best response to what he or she believes that the other players are doing. The logic of Nash equilibrium leads us to the conclusion that all players will pick 0. Everyone picking zero is the only strategy where each of the players is choosing a best response to what they believe other players are doing, and each is right about what they believe the others will be doing. When people play this game, they rarely pick zero on the first go-round. This is convincing evidence against the predictive power of Nash equilibrium. On the other hand, when they play the game even two or three times, they get very close to the Nash result. That is convincing evidence in favor of Nash. Our view is that both perspectives are correct. To get to a Nash equilibrium, all players have to choose best responses, which is relatively straightforward. They also all have to have correct beliefs about what the other players will be doing in the game. This is much harder. It is theoretically possible to develop a set of internally consistent beliefs without playing the game, but it is often easier to play the game. To the extent that players learn that their beliefs were wrong by playing the game, and then learn how to do a better job predicting what others will do, they will converge to a Nash equilibrium. While experience is helpful, it is no guarantee of success. One problem arises when there are multiple Nash equilibria. Consider the annoying problem of what to do when a mobile phone call gets dropped. Should you wait for the other person to call you, or should you call? Waiting is a best response if you think the other person will call, and calling is a best response if you think the other person will wait. The problem here is that there are two equally attractive Nash equilibria. You call and the other person waits, or you wait and the other person calls. Experience doesn't always help get you there. If you both wait, then you might decide to call. But if you both happen to call at the same time, then you get busy signals, or at least you did in the days before call waiting. To resolve this dilemma, we often turn to social conventions, such as having the person who first made the call do the callback. At least that way, you know the person has the number. Epilogue to Part 1. In the previous four chapters, we introduced several concepts and methods, using examples from business, sports, politics, and so forth as vehicles. In the chapters to follow, we will put the ideas and techniques to work. Here, we recapitulate and summarize them for ready reference. A game is a situation of strategic interdependence. The outcome of your choices, strategies, depends upon the choices of one or more other persons acting purposely. The decision makers involved in a game are called players, and their choices are called moves. The interests of the players in a game may be in strict conflict. One person's gain is always another's loss. Such games are called zero sum. More typically, there are zones of commonality of interests as well as of conflict, and so there can be combinations of mutually gainful or mutually harmful strategies. Nevertheless, we usually refer to the other players in a game as one's rivals. The moves in a game may be sequential or simultaneous. In a game of sequential moves, there is a linear chain of thinking. If I do this, my rival can do that, and in turn, I can respond in the following way. Such a game is studied by drawing a game tree. The best choices of moves can be found by applying Rule 1, look forward and reason backward. In a game with simultaneous moves, there is a logical circle of reasoning. I think that he thinks that I think that, and so on. This circle must be squared. One must see through the rival's action even though one cannot see it when making one's own move. To tackle such a game, construct a table that shows the outcomes corresponding to all conceivable combinations of choices. Then, proceed in the following steps. Begin by seeing if either side has a dominant strategy, one that outperforms all of that side's other strategies, irrespective of the rival's choice. This leads to Rule 2. If you have a dominant strategy, use it. If you don't have a dominant strategy, but your rival does, then count on his using it and choose your best response accordingly. Next, if neither side has a dominant strategy, see if either has a dominated strategy, one that is uniformly worse for the side playing it than at least one of its other strategies. If so, apply Rule 3. Eliminate dominated strategies from consideration. Go on doing so successively. If during the process any dominant strategies emerge in the smaller games, they should be chosen. If this procedure ends in a unique solution, you have found the prescriptions of action for the players and the outcome of the game. Even if the procedure does not lead to a unique outcome, it can reduce the size of the game to a more manageable level. Finally, if there are neither dominant nor dominated strategies, or after the game has been simplified as far as possible using the second step, apply Rule 4. Look for an equilibrium, a pair of strategies in which each player's action is the best response to the others. If there is a unique equilibrium of this kind, there are good arguments why all players should choose it. If there are many such equilibria, one needs a commonly understood rule or convention for choosing one over the others. If there is no such equilibrium, that usually means that any systematic behavior can be exploited by one's rivals, which indicates the need for mixing one's plays, the subject of the next chapter. In practice, games can have some sequential moves and some simultaneous moves. In that case, a combination of these techniques must be employed to think about and determine one's best choice of actions. Part 2. Chapter 5. Choice and Chance. Wit's End. The Prince's Bride is a brilliant, whimsical comedy. Among its many memorable scenes, the battle of wits between the hero, Westley, and a villain, the Sicilian Vicini, ranks high. Westley challenges Vicini to the following game. Westley will poison one of two glasses of wine out of Vicini's sight. Then, Vicini will choose to drink from one, and Westley must drink from the other. Vicini claims to be far smarter than Westley. Have you ever heard of Plato? Aristotle? Socrates? Morons. He therefore believes he can win by reasoning. All I have to do is divine from what I know of you. Are you the sort of man who would put the poison into his own goblet or his enemy's? Now, a clever man would put the poison into his own goblet, because he would know that only a great fool would reach for what he was given. I am not a great fool, so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of you. But you must have known I was not a great fool. You would have counted on it, so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of me. He goes on to other considerations, all of which go in similar logical circles. Finally, he distracts Westley, switches the goblets, and laughs confidently as both drink from their respective glasses. He says to Westley, "You fell victim to one of the classic blunders. The most famous is, never get involved in a land war in Asia. But only slightly less well known is this, never go in against a Sicilian when death is on the line." Vicini is still laughing at his expected victory when he suddenly falls over dead. Why did Vicini's reasoning fail? Each of his arguments was innately self-contradictory. If Vicini reasons that Westley would poison goblet A, his deduction is that he should choose goblet B. But Westley can also make the same logical deduction, in which case he should poison goblet B. But Vicini should foresee this, and therefore should choose goblet A. But there is no end to this circle of logic. Vicini's dilemma arises in many games. Imagine you are about to shoot a penalty kick in soccer. Do you shoot to the goalie's left or right? Suppose some consideration, your being left-footed versus right-footed, the goalie being left-handed versus right-handed. Or which side you chose the last time you took a penalty kick suggests that you should choose left. If the goalie is able to think through this thinking, then he will mentally and even physically prepare to cover that side, so you will do better by choosing his right instead. But what if the goalie raises his level of thinking one notch? Then you would have done better by sticking to the initial idea of kicking to his left, and so on. Where does it end? The only logically valid deduction in such situations is that if you follow any system or pattern in your choices, it will be exploited by the other player to his advantage and to your disadvantage. Therefore, you should not follow any such system or pattern. If you are known to be a left-side kicker, goalies will cover that side better and save your kicks more often. You have to keep them guessing by being unsystematic or random on any single occasion. Deliberately choosing your actions at random may seem irrational in something that purports to be rational strategic thinking, but there is method in this apparent madness. The value of randomization can be quantified, not merely understood in a vague general sense. In this chapter, we will explicate this method. Mixing it up on the soccer field. The penalty kick in soccer is indeed the simplest and the best-known example of the general situation requiring random moves or, in game-theoretic jargon, mixed strategies. It has been much studied in theoretical and empirical research on games and discussed in the media. A penalty is awarded for a specified set of prohibited actions or fouls by the defense in a marked rectangular area in front of its goal. Penalty kicks are also used as a tiebreaker of last resort at the end of a soccer match. The goal is 8 yards wide and 8 feet high. The ball is put on a spot 12 yards from the goal line, directly in front of the midpoint of the goal. The kicker has to shoot the ball directly from this spot. The goalie has to stand on the goal line at the midpoint of the goal and is not allowed to leave the goal line until the kicker strikes the ball. A well-kicked ball takes only 0.2 seconds to go from the spot to the goal line. A goalie who waits to see which way the ball has been kicked cannot hope to stop it unless it happens to be aimed directly at him. The goal area is wide. Therefore, the goalie must decide in advance whether to jump to cover one side and, if so, whether to jump left or right. The kicker in his run-up to the spot must also decide which way to kick before he sees which way the goalie is leaning. Of course, each will do his best to disguise his choice from the other. Therefore, the game is best regarded as one with simultaneous moves. In fact, it is rare for the goalie to stand in the center without jumping left or right, and also relatively rare for the kicker to kick to the center of the goal, and such behavior can also be explained theoretically. Therefore, we will simplify the exposition by limiting each player to just 2 choices. Since kickers usually kick using the inside of their foot, the natural direction of kicking for a right-footed kicker is to the goalie's right, and for a left-footed kicker, it is to the goalie's left. For simplicity of writing, we will refer to the natural side as right, so the choices are left and right for each player. When the goalie chooses right, it means the kicker's natural side. With 2 choices for each player and simultaneous moves, we can depict the outcomes in the usual 2x2 game payoff table. For each combination of choices of left and right by each of the 2 players, there is still some element of chance. For example, the kick may sail over the crossbar, or the goalie may touch the ball only to deflect it into the net. We measure the kicker's payoff by the percentage of times a goal is scored for that combination of choices, and the goalie's payoff by the percentage of times a goal is not scored. Of course, these numbers are specific to the particular kicker and the goalie, and detailed data are available from the top professional soccer leagues in many countries. For illustrative purposes, consider the average over a number of different kickers and goalies collected by Ignacio Palacios Huerta from the top Italian, Spanish, and English leagues for the period 1995 to 2000. Remember that in each cell, the payoff shown in the southwest corner belongs to the row player, kicker, and that shown in the northeast corner belongs to the column player, goalie. The kicker's payoffs are higher when the 2 choose the opposite sides than when they choose the same side. When the 2 choose opposite sides, the kicker's success rate is almost the same whether the side is natural or not. The only reason for failure is a shot that goes too wide or too high. Within the pair of outcomes when the two choose the same side, the kicker's payoff is higher when he chooses his natural side than when he chooses his non-natural side. All of this is quite intuitive. Let us look for a Nash equilibrium of this game. Both playing left is not an equilibrium because when the goalie is playing left, the kicker can improve his payoff from 58 to 93 by switching to right. But that cannot be an equilibrium either, because then the goalie can improve his payoff from 7 to 30 by switching to right also. But in that case, the kicker does better by switching to left, and then the goalie does better by also switching to left. In other words, the game, as depicted, does not have a Nash equilibrium at all. The cycles of switching neatly follow the cycles of Vicini's circular logic as to which goblet would contain the poison. And the fact that the game has no Nash equilibrium in the stated pairs of strategies is exactly the game theoretic statement of the importance of mixing one's moves. What we need to do is to introduce mixing as a new kind of strategy and then look for a Nash equilibrium in this expanded strategy set. To prepare for that, we will refer to the strategies originally specified, left and right, for each player as the pure strategies. Before we proceed with the analysis, let us simplify the game table. This game has the special feature that the two players' interests are exactly opposed. In each cell, the goalie's payoff is always 100 minus the kicker's payoff. Therefore, comparing cells, whenever the kicker has a higher payoff, the goalie has a lower payoff, and vice versa. Many people's raw intuition about games, derived from their experience of sports just like this one, is that each game must have a winner and a loser. However, in the general world of games of strategy, such games of pure conflict are relatively rare. Games in economics, where players engage in voluntary trade for mutual benefit, can have outcomes where everyone wins. Prisoner's dilemmas illustrate situations where everyone can lose. And bargaining and chicken games can have lopsided outcomes in which one side wins at the expense of the other. So most games involve a mixture of conflict and common interest. However, the case of pure conflict was the first to be studied theoretically and retains some special interest. As we have seen, such games are called zero-sum. The idea being that the payoff of one player is always exactly the negative of that of the other player. Or, more generally, constant sum, as in the present case, where the two players' payoffs always sum to 100. The game table for such games can be simplified in appearance by showing only one player's payoff, since the other's payoff may be understood as the negative of that of the first player, or as a constant, such as 100, minus the first player's payoff, as is the case in this example. Usually, the row player's payoff is shown explicitly. In that case, the row player prefers outcomes with the larger numbers, and the column player prefers outcomes with the smaller numbers. With this convention, the payoff table for the penalty kick game looks like this. If you are the kicker, which of the two pure strategies would you prefer? If you choose your left, the goalie can keep your success percentage down to 58 by choosing his left. If you choose your right, the goalie can keep your success percentage down to 70 by choosing his right also. Of the two, you prefer the right-right combination. Can you do better? Suppose you choose left or right at random, in proportions of 50 to 50. For example, as you stand ready to run up and kick, you toss a coin in the palm of your hand out of the goalie's sight and choose left if the coin shows tails and right if it shows heads. If the goalie chooses his left, your mixture will succeed 1/2 times 58 plus 1/2 times 93 equals 75.5% of the time. If the goalie chooses his right, your mixture will succeed 1/2 times 95 plus 1/2 times 70 equals 82.5% of the time. If the goalie believes you are making your choice according to such a mixture, he will choose his left to hold your success rate down to 75.5%. but that is still better than the 70 you would have achieved by using the better of your two pure strategies. An easy way to check whether randomness is needed is to ask whether there is any harm in letting the other player find out your actual choice before he responds. When this would be disadvantageous to you, there is advantage in randomness that keeps the other guessing. Is 50-50 the best mixture for you? No. Try a mixture where you choose your left 40% of the time and your right 60% of the time. To do so, you might take a small book in your pocket, and as you stand ready to run up for your kick, take it out and open it at a random page out of the goalie's sight. If the last digit of the page number is between 1 and 4, choose your left. If it is between 5 and 0, choose your right. Now the success rate of your mixture against the goalie's left is 0.4 times 58 plus 0.6 times 93 equals 79. And against the goalie's right, it is 0.4 times 95 plus 0.6 times 70 equals 80. The goalie can hold you down to 79 by choosing his left, but that is better than the 75.5% you could have achieved with a 50-50 mix. Observe how the successively better mixture proportions for the kicker are narrowing the difference between the success rates against the goalie's left and right choices. From the 93-70 difference for the better of the kicker's two pure strategies, to the 82.5-75.5 difference for the 50-50 mix, to the 80-79 difference for the 40-60 mix. It should be intuitively clear that your best mixture proportion achieves the same rate of success whether the goalie chooses his left or his right. That also fits with the intuition that mixing moves is good because it prevents the other player from exploiting any systematic choice or pattern of choices. A little calculation, which we postpone to a later section of this chapter, reveals that the best mixture for the kicker is to choose his left 38.3% of the time and his right 61.7% of the time. This achieves a success rate of 0.383 times 58 plus 0.617 times 93 equals 79.6% against the goalie's left, and 0.383 times 95 plus 0.617 times 70 equals 79.6% against the goalie's right. What about the goalie's strategy? If he chooses the pure strategy left, the kicker can achieve 93% success by choosing his own right. If the goalie chooses his pure strategy right, the kicker can achieve 95% success by choosing his own left. By mixing, the goalie can hold the kicker down to a much lower success rate. The best mixture for the goalie is one that gives the kicker the same success rate whether he chooses to kick to the left or the right. It turns out that the goalie should choose the proportions of his left and right at 41.7 and 58.3, respectively, and this gives the kicker a success rate of 79.6%. Notice one seeming coincidence. The success percentage the kicker can ensure by choosing his best mixture, namely 79.6, is the same as the success percentage to which the goalie can hold down the kicker by choosing his own best mixture. Actually, this is no coincidence. It is an important general property of mixed strategy equilibria in games of pure conflict, zero-sum games. This result, called the Minimax Theorem, is due to Princeton mathematician and polymath John von Neumann. It was later elaborated by him in co-authorship with Princeton economist Oscar Morgenstern in their classic book, Theory of Games and Economic Behavior, which can be said to have launched the whole subject of game theory. The theorem states that in zero-sum games in which the player's interests are strictly opposed, one's gain is the other's loss, one player should attempt to minimize his opponent's maximum payoff while his opponent attempts to maximize his own minimum payoff. When they do so, the surprising conclusion is that the minimum of the maximum, minimax, payoffs equals the maximum of the minimum, maximin, payoffs. The general proof of the Minimax theorem is quite complicated, but the result is useful and worth remembering. If all you want to know is the gain of one player or the loss of the other when both play their best mixes, you need only compute the best mix for one of them and determine its result. Theory and reality. How close is the performance of actual kickers and goalies to our theoretical calculations about the respective best mixtures? The following table is constructed from Palacios Huerta's data and our calculations. Pretty good, huh? In each case, the actual mixture proportions are quite close to the best. The actual mixtures yield almost equal success rates regardless of the other player's choice, and therefore are close to being immune to exploitation by the other. Similar evidence of agreement between actual play and theoretical predictions comes from top-level professional tennis matches. This is to be expected. The same people regularly play against one another and study their opponents' methods. Any reasonably obvious pattern would be noticed and exploited. And the stakes are large in terms of money, achievement, and fame. Therefore, the players have strong incentives not to make mistakes. However, the success of game theory is not complete or universal. Later in this chapter, we will examine how well or poorly the theory of mixed strategies succeeds in other games and why. First, let us summarize the general principle expressed here in the form of a rule for action. Rule 5. In a game of pure conflict, zero-sum game, if it would be disadvantageous for you to let the opponent see your actual choice in advance, then you benefit by choosing at random from your available pure strategies. The proportions in your mix should be such that the opponent cannot exploit your choice by pursuing any particular pure strategy from the ones available to him. That is, you get the same average payoff when your mixture is pitted against each of the pure strategies in his mixture. One word of caution. The other player may use only a subset of his available pure strategies in his mixture because the others would give him a particularly low payoff or give you a particularly good payoff. The equilibrium solution will tell you which strategies are active in his mixture. When one player follows this rule, the other cannot do any better by using one of his own pure strategies than another. Therefore, he is indifferent between them and cannot do any better than to use the mixture prescribed for him by the same rule. When both follow the rule, then neither gets any better payoff by deviating from this behavior. This is just the definition of Nash equilibrium from Chapter 4. In other words, what we have when both players use this rule is a Nash equilibrium in mixed strategies. So the von Neumann-Morgenstern Minimax theorem can be regarded as a special case of the more general theory of Nash. The Minimax theorem works only for two-player zero-sum games, while the Nash equilibrium concept can be used with any number of players and any mixture of conflict and common interest in the game. Equilibria of zero-sum games don't necessarily have to involve mixed strategies. As a simple example, suppose the kicker has very low success rates when kicking to the left, his non-natural side, even when the goalie guesses wrong. This can happen because there is a significant probability that the kicker will miss the target anyway when kicking with the outside of his foot. Specifically, suppose the payoff table is... Then the strategy right is dominant for the kicker, and there is no reason to mix. More generally, there can be equilibria in pure strategies without dominance, but this is no cause for concern. The methods for finding mixed strategy equilibria will also yield such pure strategy equilibria as special cases of mixtures where the proportion of the one strategy in the mixture is the entire 100%. Child's play. On October 23, 2005, Andrew Burgill of Toronto was crowned that year's Rock, Paper, Scissors International World Champion and received the gold medal of the World RPS Society. Stan Long of Newark, California won the silver medal and Stuart Waldman of New York the bronze. The World RPS Society maintains a website www.worldrps.com, where the official rules of play and various guides to strategy are posted. It also holds an annual World Championship event. Did you know that the game you played as a child has become this big? The rules of the game are the same as the ones you followed as a kid and as described in Chapter 1. Two players simultaneously choose, throw in the technical jargon of the game, one of three hand signals. Rock is a fist, paper is a horizontal flat palm, and scissors is signified by holding out the index and middle fingers at an angle to each other and pointed toward the opponent. If the two players make the same choice, it is a tie. If the two make different choices, rock wins against, breaks, scissors, scissors wins against, cuts, paper, and paper wins against, covers, rock. Each pair plays many times in succession, and the winner of a majority of these plays is the winner of that match. The elaborate rules set out on the webpage of the World RPS Society ensure two things. First, they describe in precise terms the hand shapes that constitute each type of throw. This prevents any attempts at cheating, where one player makes some ambiguous gesture, which he later claims to be the one that beats what his opponent chose. Second, they describe a sequence of actions called the prime, the approach, and the delivery, intended to ensure that the two players' moves are simultaneous. This prevents one player from seeing in advance what the other has done and making the winning response to it. Thus, we have a two-player simultaneous move game with three pure strategies for each. If a win counts as 1 point, a loss as negative one, and a tie as 0, the game table is as follows, with the players named Andrew and Stan in honor of their achievements in the 2005 World Championships. What would game theory recommend? This is a zero-sum game, and revealing your move in advance can be disadvantageous. If Andrew chooses just one pure move, Stan can always make a winning response and hold Andrew's payoff down to negative one. If Andrew mixes the three moves in equal proportions of one-third each, it gives him the average payoff of one-third times one plus one-third times zero plus one-third times negative one equals zero against any one of Stan's pure strategies. With the symmetric structure of the game, this is quite obviously the best that Andrew can do, and calculation confirms this intuition. The same argument goes for Stan. Therefore, mixing all three strategies in equal proportions is best for both and yields a Nash equilibrium in mixed strategies. However, this is not how most participants in the championships play. The website labels this the chaos play and advises against it. Critics of this strategy insist that there is no such thing as a random throw. Human beings will always use some impulse or inclination to choose a throw and will therefore settle into unconscious but nonetheless predictable patterns. The chaos school has been dwindling in recent years as tournament statistics show the greater effectiveness of other strategies. The problem of settling into unconscious but nonetheless predictable patterns is indeed a serious one deserving further discussion, to which we will turn in a moment. But first, let us see what kinds of strategies are favored by participants in the World RPS Championship. The website lists several gambits, like the cleverly named strategy Bureaucrat, which consists of three successive throws of paper, or scissor sandwich, which consists of paper, scissors, paper. Another is the exclusion strategy, which leaves out one of the throws. The idea behind these is that opponents will focus their entire strategy on predicting when the pattern will change or when the missing throw will appear, and you can exploit this weakness in their reasoning. There are also physical skills of deception and detection of the opponent's deception. The players watch each other's body language and hands for signals of what they are about to throw. They also try to deceive the opponent by acting in a way that suggests one throw and choosing a different one instead. Soccer penalty kickers and goalies similarly watch each other's legs and body movements to guess which way the other will go. Such skills matter, for example, in the penalty shootout that decided the 2006 World Cup quarterfinal match between England and Portugal. The Portuguese goalie guessed correctly every time and saved three of the kicks, which clinched the victory for his team. Mixing it up in the laboratory. By contrast, with the remarkable agreement between theory and reality of mixed strategies on the soccer field and the tennis court, the evidence from laboratory experiments is mixed or even negative. The first book-length treatment of experimental economics declared flatly, "Subjects in experiments are rarely, if ever, observed flipping coins." What explains this difference? Some of the reasons are the same as those discussed in Chapter 4, when we contrasted the two kinds of empirical evidence. The laboratory setting involves somewhat artificially structured games played by novice subjects for relatively small stakes, whereas the field setting has experienced players engaged in familiar games for stakes that are huge in terms of fame and prestige, and often also in terms of money. Another limitation of the experimental setting may be at work. The experiments always begin with a session where the rules are carefully explained, and the experimenters go to great lengths to ensure that the subjects understand the rules. The rules make no explicit mention of the possibility of randomization and don't provide coins or dice or the instruction, "You are allowed, if you wish, to flip the coins or roll the dice to decide what you are going to do." Then it is hardly surprising that the subjects, instructed to follow the rules precisely as stated, don't flip coins. We have known ever since Stanley Milgram's renowned experiment that subjects treat experimenters as authority figures to be obeyed. It is hardly surprising that they follow the rules literally and do not think of randomizing. However, the fact remains that even when the laboratory games were structured to be similar to soccer penalty kicks, where the value of mixing moves is evident, the subjects do not seem to have used randomization either correctly or appropriately over time. Thus, we have a mixed record of success and failure for the theory of mixed strategies. Let us develop some of these findings a little further, both to understand what we should expect in games we observe and to learn how to play better. How to act randomly. Randomization does not mean alternating between the pure strategies. If a pitcher is told to mix fastballs and forkballs in equal proportions, he should not throw a fastball, then a forkball, then a fastball again, and so on in strict rotation. The batters will quickly notice the pattern and exploit it. Similarly, if the proportion of fastballs to forkballs is to be 60-40, that does not mean throwing six fastballs followed by four forkballs and so on. What should the pitcher do when mixing fastballs and forkballs randomly in equal proportions? One way is to pick a number at random between 1 and 10. If the number is 5 or less, throw a fastball. If the number is 6 or above, go for the forkball. Of course, this only reduces the problem one layer. How do you go about picking a random number between 1 and 10? Let us start with the simpler problem of trying to write down what a random sequence of coin tosses will look like. If the sequence is truly random, then anyone who tries to guess what you write down will be correct no more than 50% on average. But writing down such a random sequence is more difficult than you might imagine. Psychologists have found that people tend to forget that heads is just as likely to be followed by heads as by tails. Therefore, they have too many reversals and too few strings of heads in their successive guesses. If a fair coin toss comes up heads 30 times in a row, the next toss is still equally likely to be heads or tails. There is no such thing as being due for tails. Similarly, in the lottery, last week's number is just as likely to win again as any other number. The knowledge that people fall into the error of too many reversals explains many of the stratagems and gambits used by participants in the World RPS Championships. Players attempt to exploit this weakness and, at the next higher level, attempt to exploit these attempts in turn. The player who throws paper thrice in succession is looking for the opponent to think that a fourth paper is unlikely, and the player who leaves out one of the throws and mixes among just the other two in many successive plays is trying to exploit the opponent's thinking that the missing throw is due. To avoid getting caught putting order into the randomness, you need a more objective or independent mechanism. One such trick is to choose some fixed rule, but one that is both secret and sufficiently complicated that it is difficult to discover. Look, for example, at the length of our sentences. If the sentence has an odd number of words, call it heads. If the sentence length is even